This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories reported on by Odyssey's radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we're looking into the latest developments in the case of Nick Reiner, who is accused of killing his parents, beloved Hollywood power couple Rob and Michelle Reiner. He's been trying to access the trust fund his parents set up for him to pay for his defense. But is that a violation of the Slayer rule? We'll look into that. Another case we're diving into in this episode also involves family murder. It's the Lindsay Clancy case out of Massachusetts. Clancy is a mother accused of killing her three children, and the details of her case have opened up a discussion around postpartum depression and the more rare postpartum psychosis condition. We'll also touch on the investigation into the death of actress Hayden Panettiere, though crime is not currently suspected in that case. Before we get into those cases, we'll cover some crime updates from across the U.S., including Derek Chauvin's attempt to get his 2020 murder conviction for the death of George Floyd overturned. Then we'll hear discussions about parents getting punished when their children commit crimes, and about school shooter drills. First, we have the case of an 18-year-old accused of killing his girlfriend, a recent high school graduate who was headed to California, where she was set to play soccer for Penn West. Here's the Big K Morning Show out of Odyssey Station KDKA in Pittsburgh with the story.
State police say a college soccer player was killed Wednesday night by her boyfriend. His mother is accused of trying to help him cover it up. 18-year-old Royce Moser is charged with homicide in the death of 18-year-old Caroline Heintz, a recent graduate of Peters High School and a student at Penn West, California. Moser's mother, Rachel, is charged with hindering apprehension, evidence tampering, and more. The DA says Royce and Caroline were talking about the future of their relationship when he stabbed her in the chest. Moser allegedly put Caroline's body in her vehicle and drove to his mother's house where attempts were made to clean up the blood. Investigators say Moser, followed by his mother, drove to California Borough and left his dead girlfriend and her SUV in a parking lot. Trooper Rocco Gagliardi.
We're talking about an 18-year-old girl that was ready to start life, and now she can no longer get to pursue her dreams, which is really unfortunate.
Court paperwork says Moser told investigators a demon told him to stab his girlfriend.
Odyssey Station KYW News Radio in Philadelphia reported on sentencing for men convicted of killing a rapper in 2020. Like in our last dispatch, the victim was just 18 years old when he died.
Two men convicted in the murder of an 18-year-old rapper 6 years ago in West Philly learned their fate today. Donovan Williams will spend the rest of his life in prison for his role in the July 2020 shooting death of Amir Johnson Day. Baj Dini was sentenced to 13.5 to 42 years. District Attorney Larry Krasner says this was a long time coming.
Here we are 6 years after the homicide, and finally, there is a verdict, and finally, there is a consequence.
The shooting happened on July 5th of 2020 at a home on 61st Street near Master Street. The DA says it took more than 15 months to track down one of the defendants and 3 years to find the other. Day's mother says she's grateful for the persistence of investigators.
And I just wanted to thank everybody who put in all of this time to give my son justice. His birthday is this month, so this is a perfect happy birthday for him.
Krasner's office still seeking information on this shooting, though, saying one or two more people may have been involved.
One of the most reported on and discussed crime cases of 2020 was the killing of black man George Floyd at the hands of white police officer Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis. Chauvin was convicted in connection with the death and is currently serving concurrent state and federal sentences that are both more than 20 years. Now he's seeking to have his state murder conviction overturned. Odyssey's WCCO News and Talk in the Twin Cities has the details.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is again asking for his state murder conviction in the 2020 killing of George Floyd to be overturned.
Chauvin and his legal team argue the assignment of Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison to prosecute the case was illegitimate. They also argue that Chauvin's due process rights were violated because the Hennepin County District Court failed to convene a grand jury before any charging decision. Previous legal efforts by Chauvin have been unsuccessful, including when the Supreme Court rejected an appeal of his conviction for second-degree murder. Two other attempts for post-conviction relief have also been rejected. Mark Fry, News Talk 830 WCCO.
Chauvin right now is simultaneously serving a 21-year federal sentence for violating Floyd's civil rights and a 22.5-year state sentence for second-degree murder.
In Detroit, Odyssey station WWJ News Radio provided an update on the case of a man accused of killing multiple family members.
25-year-old Livonia man accused of killing multiple family members in June appeared in court for a competency hearing this morning and is now seeking an independent review.
25-year-old Gage Pierce, the man accused of shooting and killing his mother, father, brother, and brother's girlfriend in their Livonia home in June, has been ruled incompetent to stand trial, but will now undergo an independent review to see if he can be ruled competent. At this morning's hearing in 16th District Court in Livonia, Pierce spoke on his own behalf as to why he thinks he should be ruled competent.
What I would like to speak on is has been falsely misconstrued in those reports that my expressions have been unduly limited in the sense of, firstly, I am confined to a space where it's a sub-day room in section 2C of this jail, where I am stuck in such a shielded space with lack of sunlight.
Pierce also said instances of him laughing don't reflect his competency in this case. There was talk about his ability to work with his attorney as well, and Pierce ended up requesting a new attorney at the end of the hearing. About a dozen family and friends were in attendance for the proceedings, which will now be picked up on October 29th, with Pierce facing four counts of first-degree murder. In Livonia, Luke Sloan, WWJ News Radio 9.
Now we'll hear some discussion related to the parents of children who commit crimes and school shootings, two issues that have intersected in at least two cases. The Oxford school shooting committed by 15-year-old Ethan Crumbly in Michigan, and the Appalachie High School shooting committed by 14-year-old Colt Gray in Georgia. In both cases, the young teen's parents have also faced legal ramifications for the tragedies along with their sons. Tommy Tucker of Odyssey Station WWL in New Orleans, Louisiana, discussed parental responsibility when their children commit crimes with an expert this week. Let's listen in.
Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. Good morning, Dane. How are you?
Morning, Tommy. Just fine.
Talking about today, parental responsibility when it comes to kids and committing crimes. What does the Louisiana law say, Dane? At what point is a parent responsible for a crime their kid commits?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question that we see with prosecutions across the country. But in Louisiana, a child's crime isn't automatically the parent's crime. But if a parent knowingly permits or aids or is criminally negligent in supervising a child and the child engages in delinquent conduct, then there can be criminal consequences on the parent. But it's got to have that level of culpability for the parent. There's got to be some criminal negligence or knowledge or willful conduct where the parent's allowing the minor to engage in conduct that's specified in the statute, things like violating curfew, missing school, underage drinking, having guns, those sorts of things.
I was going to ask you, criminally negligent seems like a somewhat subjective term. Does the law lay out what specifically a parent can, I guess I start to say, do or fail to do to get them in trouble as far as the kid's behavior is concerned?
Well, criminal negligence is one of those indeterminate terms in the law that we know that negligence means that a person does or fails to do something that a reasonable person would have done under similar circumstances. But in criminal cases, it's even more indeterminate and stringent in the sense that it's got to not be ordinary negligence, but a gross deviation from the standard of care of what a reasonable person would do. So I just threw out a lot of legal jargon there, but didn't really answer a lot of questions. That's the tough tough question presented to judges and juries when they have to evaluate whether someone was negligent in either a criminal or a civil case.
Back to that reasonable person kind of thing?
Back to the reasonable person standard of care. Yeah, it's something that I'm talking about it today in my contracts class. It's something that comes up in all areas of the law. It's fairly, from a legal scholarship standpoint, fairly controversial imposing criminal liability for just mere negligence when somebody didn't know of a risk, but they should have known of the risk. But that's what happens in these child supervision cases.
And I'm just wondering, Dane, does the fact that a parent is held responsible for the child's crime, does that lessen the culpability on the part of the child, or are we punishing everybody here?
No, children are held responsible in juvenile court for their crimes every day. So this is nothing that lessens the child's responsibility for juvenile delinquency, but the parents are held accountable for not adequately supervising.
There's no sliding scale of, okay, Junior did this, but the parents didn't do that, so therefore Junior's not really responsible for that. None of that happens at all.
Yeah, and in fact, it seems that to me anyway, that this parental criminal responsibility is almost a lightning strike. There are, you only see it really in these high-profile cases, the school shooter cases, the mass shootings. You don't really see it for ordinary juvenile delinquency, of which there is a lot of in urban centers all over the United States. You don't see a lot of efforts by prosecutors in those kind of, I hate to say it, but ordinary run-of-the-mill cases of juvenile delinquency. But if it's a high-profile case and it's investigated and the parents are found to be somewhat culpable or very culpable, then you see the prosecutions.
I remember doing an interview with somebody, and I don't remember the details of it, but it was basically they called the police on their own child because they couldn't do anything. It's like, I don't know, he's out of control. Help me out here. Would that be a mitigating factor if the parents had done something like that beforehand?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, very much so. Any real effort by parents to get help or assistance from law enforcement or social workers is going to be looked upon by prosecutors quite favorably.
What about the civil aspect of this?
That's a lot easier. Parents are responsible for the torts committed by their children, and they can even be liable without without being negligent themselves. So we are almost strictly liable for the torts committed by our children. And there's often typically insurance coverage for that sort of thing. But that's a lot easier case to make. And you do see that those sorts of lawsuits brought more often by personal injury lawyers.
And apparently there's no floor on that. But what about the ceiling? Is it the age of majority, 17?
Yeah, I mean, once a child is 18 years old, he's responsible for his own torts, and his parents aren't going to be responsible for those. So, you know, that's why some parents have been known to emancipate their children in an effort to avoid liability for torts committed by wayward children. You don't see it often, but it's something that parents have thought about.
You read my mind because that's what I was going to ask you. What is the legal age to emancipate a child in Louisiana?
Well, I mean, there's judicial emancipation. There's emancipation by juridical act. I'd have to research the exact ages. It's not something you really see very often, but it is an option.
Primarily, that's to avoid liability. A parent would do that, right, for the most part?
That's right, and courts are going to be reluctant to do that because the law assumes that parents are going to be responsible for rearing their children. And by emancipating a kid, that's essentially saying the parents have given up on parental authority.
Is it in practice more of a threat than like you're talking about a lightning bolt? It seems like when rather than I know they got a study that the University of Nebraska Lincoln did with police chiefs and prosecuting attorneys. They said it's not really effective, but they do bring it out, I guess, sometimes politically when it's like we're going to charge your parents on this because they were negligent when, in fact, like you're saying, the high profile cases get the attention, but not the everyday cases of juvenile delinquency.
That's exactly right. And I mean, that's really no way to run a criminal justice system is just to pick out the cases that are on TV for prosecution. But in this unusual area of criminal responsibility, that is something that does seem to drive some of these prosecutions.
Schools across the U.S. have active shooter drills to prepare staff and students for potential school shooting incidents. According to gun violence prevention organization Everytown USA, over 95% of American schools have active shooter drills. Following the 1999 Columbine High School massacre in Colorado, these shooter drills have become more common. However, some question how effective the drills actually are. And there has been some evidence that suggests they are detrimental to the mental health of students who go through them. In Kansas, a new law just changed the way these drills work. Dana Wright, Scott Parks, and Sam Stevie III of the Dana and Parks Show on Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City discuss the news.
Story here from Channel 5. Kansas schools cannot conduct an active shooter drill without first notifying parents, and families have the right to opt their children out under a new state law taking effect this year. The Students Safe at School Act applies to every public and private school in Kansas. Under the law, schools must notify parents at least 24 hours before any active shooter drill. Students who opt out face no punishment. The law also bans drills that simulate a real shooting. You can't use fake gunshots. After every drill, schools must debrief students and have mental health support on site. By the way, K through 5 no longer will participate in any.
We've just traumatized a generation or two of people over this, and teachers. Do not forget the staff.
Yeah, of course.
There are teachers who have called into this program who said they, you know, what are we doing? Where you've got the SWAT team bursting in. And I know we don't do this anymore, but back several years ago,
post-Columbine,
we're gonna surprise attack everybody, and let's just see how good you are at throwing a chair at the fake gunman who is. What are we doing?
We had a overhead call at my grade school, so every year we had the fire drill, the tornado drill, and it seemed like we had one of fire and tornado for every three active shooter drills, and this was early 2000s. And the call would come over the loudspeaker, and all the kids would run into the corner of the classroom, and they'd lock the door, and the principal would literally run around the school banging on different classroom doors. And if he could hear us inside, we would then go over, you know, remain quiet, stay out of sight of the doors. I wouldn't say it was traumatizing.
Did you know these were drills?
Yeah.
You knew they were drills. Okay.
We had a certain call over the loudspeaker to know it was a drill, and a certain call over the loudspeaker to know this is the real deal. But I don't really, in an emergency like that, the teachers need to know what to do.
Agreed.
Not the students. And the students are going to be freaking out either way if it's real.
So are the teachers.
I remember the day that I thought, that's it. I'm packing up the family and we're moving out of here. And it was a day I was on the air and I got the sweetest, that sweet little face, a text, and it was a selfie from one of the children, and she said, we are on lockdown and we're in the dark and the teachers are telling us we have to hide and be quiet, but you always said to me we're supposed to run. What am I supposed to do?
Oh, boy.
And I remember that day. She was probably, 10 years ago, 11 years ago, thinking like, I'm so done. Mm-hmm. We don't have any answers for this thing. No one has the courage to have the answers that we need to fix this thing, right? And
for sure.
And I've said it before. Like, have never been so relieved that they are out of that phase of their life. And I've never asked them. I need to do that. Like, what do you remember about those drills? And do you remember being afraid? And the one drill that sent them on lockdown that I think scared the heck out of everybody was there was a report that there was somebody outside roaming around with a gun after some sort of burglary nearby or something. And it ended up being unfounded.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder, were we traumatized with the nuclear blast drill, having to climb under a fake wood desk, knowing full well we would be vaporized anyway?
Let me tell you the difference. At age 7, I didn't understand what a nuclear attack was. I knew the tone that they would do in the elementary school, and then you would go run out into the hallway and put your, you know, head against the brick.
Kiss your butt goodbye.
And that was kind of scary. Yeah. But at 7, none of us understood what we were talking about with a nuclear holocaust, which had we understood, we would have said, then why are we doing this? We're all going to be vaporized.
Mm-hmm.
7-year-olds in school today that have gone through those drills will tell you, they know exactly what the bad man with the gun looks like that's coming into that school.
Yeah.
That's the difference.
Sam, you did go through these drills. If you knew they were going to happen in advance, why would anybody make noise when somebody banged on the door anyway?
Exactly. They were pointless. It was dumb. All of us kids would get in the corner of the room and, you know, crack jokes and try to see what we could get away with in terms of how much noise we could make before the teacher was like, "You're going to get me in trouble."
I feel so bad for the teachers.
I think the tornado drill is legit.
Oh, sure.
Students should need to know.
You need to know where to go.
Teachers need to know.
Yes.
If there is a tornado, what are we going to do?
Absolutely.
And the fire drill. If you're in the bathroom and the fire alarm starts going off and, you know, what stairwell do I go down? What door do I walk out of?
All legitimate.
What is going to happen, though, if you are among the group of kids who opt out of the school shooter drill? You're just going to take you over to Starbucks for the day?
It says students will not be... cannot be punished at all.
What would the punishment be?
I don't know.
But where are they going to go is my question, because for us, it was an entire school thing.
I understand, but when they did the shooter drill at your school, where did everybody, including yourself, in the classroom go? In the classroom?
We stayed in the classroom we were in, yes.
Okay, so I'm assuming that a student who has opted, whose parents have opted out, would just sit at their desk, twiddle their thumbs.
So they're still experiencing it then.
How many?
Yeah, I guess so.
If you had to put a percentage on it, what percentage of people do you think will opt their kids out? Because I would have opted them out.
Depends on what the alternative is for my kid to do. So if I opt my kid out, right, and they're not to take part in the drill, to Sam's point, where do they go? Do they get moved down to the cafeteria 5 minutes before this happens?
Yeah, because in elementary school, it's not like they're going to go hop in a car and grab Starbucks.
Right. So do the kids whose parents have opted them out, are they taken to the library? Do they go to the cafeteria and just sit and wait for 10 minutes and then they get to go back to their classroom? What if they're the only one in that classroom who's been opted out?
I think you'll be surprised how many people are going to opt their kids out of this.
And I don't remember the tally, but we did have like 3 or 4 actual lockdown situations while I was there. They were never in the building, but
was it bank robbery adjacent? That's
where
the most common.
Was located.
Yeah.
There was pretty common that there were shootings like 4 or 5 blocks away.
God.
And they would be like, "Okay, we're going to go into lockdown."
Mm. I just, to your point, Dana, they are so pointless because you do have to give them advance warning. Otherwise the kids are going to lose it, and rightfully so. But if they know it's coming, you would never know that a school shooting is about to happen, sadly.
No.
Right? Sadly that they even happen. But if everybody is given a warning, oh, by the way, Timmy, tomorrow at 3 o'clock or 2 o'clock, there's going to be an active shooter drill at your school. Okay, Mom. And what are they learning?
It's just reinforcing the fact that this has happened and can happen. And really, if we're being honest, this is why I've got this problem with these new cameras that claim they can shoot a gun, like spy a gun in a hallway.
Zero eyes.
By the time that has happened and someone has that weapon inside, it's over. There's not, I mean, you can teach the kids to hide. Didn't work in Sandy Hook.
No, it didn't.
You know,
you can teach them the fire drill. It didn't work in whatever that one was.
It's also the, quite frankly, the teachers that shoulder all of that responsibility in that moment. And it usually is a teacher who loses their life protecting those kids.
Telephone number here is 913-586-7798. Would love to hear from the teachers or parents.
Can you opt out if you're a teacher? I don't want to do it.
If you're a parent, do you plan to opt your kid out?
Late last year, the nation was shocked to hear that Rob Reiner, director of heartwarming audience favorite films like Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally, and The Princess Bride, among others, was found slaughtered alongside his wife and frequent collaborator Michelle Singer Reiner. What seemed even more shocking was that the suspect arrested for the murders was their son, 32-year-old Nick Reiner. He's now on trial for murder, and he's pleaded not guilty. According to reports, Rob and Michelle's other children, son Jake Reiner and daughter Romy Reiner, testified before a grand jury that ultimately indicted Nick. Alan Jackson, an attorney known for representing Harvey Weinstein, has agreed to represent the defendant if Nick could get access to the money from a trust fund his parents established for him. Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles had the latest on the case this week.
Nick Reiner's trying to get his hands on trust fund money for his murder defense, but the judge today pushed a hearing on that to the fall. So for now, Reiner remains broke, in jail, and relying on a public defender. Here's Emily Valdez.
Nick Reiner has a public defender, and he wants big-time attorney Alan Jackson. But for that, he needs big-time money.
The Reiners had set up a trust for their children, including Nick Reiner.
Attorney Chris Melcher is not involved in the case.
There's money in that trust, and Nick, or really his attorney, wants that money for his criminal defense. But the trustee is saying, no, you can't have that money because you killed your parents.
California has what's called a slayer statute, and that means people cannot inherit or get money from people they have likely killed. Notice the word likely. The bar is lower. This is not beyond a reasonable doubt, and Reiner was indicted by a grand jury.
The judge in the probate court has sufficient information, I believe, to make a finding for that purpose of the killer heir statute that Nick Reiner is responsible for the murder of his parents to deny payments. Of course, if other evidence came out in the future, which would show that somebody else killed the Reiners, then Nick can reapply or petition for the money from the trust.
Reiner sits in jail. His bail, $1.5 million. His next probate hearing is in October. I'm Emily Valdez, KNX News.
For more on the Reiner case, Dana Wright, Scott Parks, and Sam Stevie III discussed the new developments this week.
Did you see there is a new indictment that has been handed up alleging that the son of Rob and Michelle Reiner was, quote, lying in wait before he killed them. And that is an additional upgraded charge, by the way. He has been indicted on murder charges in the killing of his parents. And now there are additional charges that he was literally, the charge is, Scott, lying in wait. I didn't know that that was a thing.
I didn't either.
The grand jury had been meeting in secret, as they do, returned the indictment on July 20th. It was unsealed today. We know what lying in wait means, that he waited or hid from his victims in order to, quote, ambush them.
What was the motive? I forget. Oh, he was just crazy? Okay.
As an allegation, it is meant to show premeditation. And of course, I don't know that many people dispute that.
Well, yeah, if you're lying in wait to kill your... Sam, yes.
Wasn't he living with them at the time?
I believe so.
It's a confusing charge, in my opinion, because wouldn't you be at the house anyway?
I was watching a Legal Observer today, and she just said, while we don't know exactly what went on in that house, we know it was violent, we know there was a struggle, and these charges would indicate that he was hiding, waiting for them to come home, likely incapacitated dad first, who would have done anything and everything to protect his wife.
Mm-hmm. See, and therein lies the difference, Sam. There is a difference between, even if he did live at the home, your parents come home, I think they were at a party that he was also at earlier in the night. there's a difference between your parents coming home and you're sitting on the couch, right? Oh, hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. I'm about to kill you. And then hiding behind the couch. I'm not saying that's where he was. I'm just using that as the example. And if he's hiding behind the couch, they walk in, think nothing is wrong, and that gives him an immediate advantage of surprise.
Did he get access to his trust for his legal
defense?
Oh, he's trying.
Listen to this. The indictment comes as he continues seeking unpaid money from a trust his parents established for him, saying he needs it to help in his defense, right? Reiner said in a court petition that the trustees who oversee the funds have denied the money to him, quote, without legal justification. The money was to have gone to Nick Reiner, quote, even if his parents were alive, according to the legal filing. Trustees won't share the exact amount, but here's what the filing says. Are you ready for this?
Be careful. I may agree with it.
Nick loved his parents.
I don't agree with that.
He is devastated by their deaths.
He's not.
But the facts about what did and did not happen to them are not the issue here. The issue is, do you still have a right to the money that they set aside for you when you killed them? Is there anything, flip it around, Scott, if someone dies and leaves you $1 million, does that come with strings? You can only access that if you're going to use it for housing, or you can only access that if you're not going to buy your girlfriend a $300,000 car. You can, you know, if there weren't strings attached to this money, they are arguing they wanted him to have it and that the reason he needs it is immaterial.
Well, but the reason he needs it is a defense in a case where I believe he has pleaded not guilty. Is that correct?
I believe so. Probably going to be an insanity plea, yes.
In our legal system, you are innocent until proven guilty. He has not been proven guilty of the murders of his parents. Therefore, I would make the legal argument that he has every right to that money.
I think there's a law, I'm pretty sure there is, that says you cannot profit off of the murder that you have committed. Now, you're going to say, and you're right,
he's not convicted.
He's not convicted yet. If you're right, that is a loophole that needs to be closed.
Why?
Because it would, follow me here, it would literally give people that are off their rocker almost ammunition to kill someone. If you know you're going to get $1.5 million, it's in a trust. If some, God forbid, if a plane goes down and something happens to mom and dad, I get $1.5 million.
Yeah.
If you make it so that there isn't a murder exception, people just go around killing people for the money.
But once you're convicted, you can't spend your parents' money.
He's asking to spend it before.
Right. He's not free. He's not out of jail right now. He's in jail.
Obviously, with this case, all signs point in one direction. But if it weren't this case and the individual didn't do it, are they not being convicted beforehand by being denied access to the money for their legal defense?
He still has a legal defense. Might not be the world's best in L.A., but he still has a defense.
Isn't he entitled to the best defense that he can afford?
I feel like there should be an asterisk in any trust that says, I am setting this money aside for you.
So long as you're not charged
with killing
me?
So long as you don't murder me.
But there's, Dana, I
know. Okay, so long as you are not indicted for my murder. I mean, shouldn't that just be baseline common sense?
No, because I will defend the system that we have. He is, at the moment, he is innocent.
At the moment, he's innocent with a public defender.
That only furthers my point. He's, because now we're going to get into a conversation about public defense. He doesn't have the best lawyer available.
Correct.
And he is facing charges that are extremely severe.
They could seek the death penalty.
Correct. At which point he would get different attorneys. I'm sure they have a death penalty defense team. We're talking about the, what's the Reiner son's name?
Nick
Reiner. Whether or not he should get the inheritance from his parents, even though he is accused of killing them, to fund his legal defense. And Dana and Sam, are of the opinion that he should not. And I am of the opinion that he should. Not because I think he's innocent, but in this country you are considered, or you are innocent until or unless you are proven guilty. And he's not at home on house arrest or anything, ordering Uber Eats or anything like that. He's in jail. He is charged with their murders.
So I was correct. It is a legal doctrine known as the Slayer Statute or the Slayer Rule. Slayer is capitalized. I'm assuming that means someone's name and not the act.
That would be
of,
a really unfortunate right. name for a law like that.
Nor the band.
Under the legal doctrine known as the Slayer Statute, an individual who commits a felonious and intentional killing is legally barred from receiving any financial benefit, inheritance, or trust payout from the victim. Now, it does. I understand what you're saying, Scott. He hasn't been convicted yet.
Yep.
So what, you give him all $1.5 million and to essentially blow, which is money that should go to the other siblings who didn't murder their parents.
Let me ask you this. Let's go to Steve in Lewisburg. Hello, Steve.
Hello. Interesting discussion. I'm glad you're bringing this up. You didn't mean to raise it directly, but I've argued for some time now that we should perhaps at least think about reconsidering, not throw it out, but reconsidering whether innocent until proven guilty is really the right thing. Keep in mind, innocent until proven guilty dates back like 3,000 years. It was codified by the Romans in like 100 AD. And we've always just lived with this idea that that's right, just, fair, a concept. But it came about at a time way before we had videotape, audio tape, ballistics, fingerprints, and a lot of other things. I just think in certain cases, the burden should shift because I don't think innocent, it made a lot of sense maybe in the Old West when it was like, hey, who pulled his gun first? And you had no proof other than people's testimony. But nowadays, when you have some pretty overwhelming physical evidence, I'm not sure innocent until proven guilty makes sense anymore.
Mm. That is an interesting and some would say radical theory, Steve. Do we not already handle certain cases, even though, okay, you are innocent until proven guilty, okay?
Correct.
Then why is there no bond? Why are you behind bars until trial? We don't let homicidal maniac mm-hmm. suspects, not convicted yet, we don't let them roam around with the rest of us.
Well, and some people would say that is unconstitutional, that there, and I can't remember which amendment it is, that you have to have basically a reasonable bond. No bond is not reasonable. I'm not making that argument. I'm saying what some people would say.
But, you know, you wouldn't want Ted Bundy living next door to you while he awaited trial.
No,
right?
I would not.
So I think in some cases, innocent until proven guilty, it's the best system that we have. Yep. But do we really believe that? And I would say to you, in high profile cases where there's a risk to the public, we don't, because we keep them in jail mm-hmm. pending their conviction.
I don't even think we have innocent until proven guilty anymore, because your entire life will be ruined even if you didn't do the crime. And say your trial takes 2 years to come together. You now spent 2 years in jail. What are you going to tell a future employer? Hey, oh, well, yeah, I was convicted of murdering my parents, but I didn't do it, and I finally got off.
Yeah.
But they kept me in jail for 2 years because they decided that was best for society.
Look at
despite
Richard
the
Jewell,
fact that I
Scott.
Wasn't a killer.
Mm-hmm. Richard Jewell, who was implicated. Was he ever charged? He was implicated in the Olympic bombing. But he didn't do it.
And was actually just...
Mm-hmm. He was actually trying to do the right
loving,
thing.
Loving, yep. Good employee.
Anna in Kansas City, you get the last word. Anna, hello.
Okay. I really feel that the money should be used for his lawyers. I believe that he was schizophrenic, and his parents, I know, did everything they could to help him, but they had put him on new medicine. He wasn't doing well on it. I don't think that he was in his right mind when he killed his parents, and I think that he needs a lawyer to help him.
Anna, thank you for the call. This is where the lying in wait charge becomes interesting, because if you had some sort of psychotic snap, right? You just snapped. Mm-hmm. Why would you lie in wait? And how long did he lie in wait? And like, that's what we don't have those details.
Right.
I think that updated indictment today on the lying in wait is kind of a wink and a nod to everybody to say, do not completely blame this on mental health. Is there a mental health component to it? Absolutely.
But he was also in and out of rehabs countless times.
Oh, his parents were at their wits' end,
He was on God knows how many medications. And who knows what that did to his psyche. From the text line, and it's a good point. You know, Steve was making the argument, well, maybe it shouldn't be innocent until proven guilty necessarily in this day and age because of all the, you know, the videos and all this stuff that we have now. Well, somebody points out on the text line, what about AI?
Yeah. But we have you on video saying this. Do we?
Hollywood was again shocked by death just last weekend. This time, 36-year-old Hayden Panettiere, an actress known for her roles on shows like Heroes and Nashville, who had been in the business since she was just a baby, was found dead. She was unresponsive when first responders found her in her Greenville, South Carolina apartment last Sunday. Her on-and-off-again boyfriend, Brian Hickerson, who faced allegations of domestic violence in 2020, was at the scene. In Panettiere's recent memoir, This Is Me, A Reckoning, she said that Hickerson once beat her so badly that she didn't leave the house for weeks. He has not been charged with anything regarding her death. Panettiere's death is under investigation by the Greenville Police Department and the Drug Enforcement Administration. Crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett joined Odyssey station WBEN in Buffalo to discuss the case.
Investigation into the death of actress Hayden Panettiere. The DEA now joining this investigation, Brad, which now over the past few days appears maybe a bit more complicated than it had initially. What's your read on what's been going on here?
So, again, we don't really know the details about this story other than, yes, she was found unconscious, had passed away. Apparently, a boy, an on-again, off-again, as has been described, boyfriend, and the boyfriend's brother apparently reported that she was unconscious. I presume they were at whatever location she was, where she was found. If there is no apparent, like, gunshots, strangulation, knife wounds, things that physically you could look at her and see that she's been hurt, then what does that leave you? It's something she ingested or snorted, whatever it might be. And so I think the preliminary was that it was a drug overdose. But the question is that true? The thing that's missed in cases like this, Brent, is that you really have to sort of dig deep into the following. You start with who found her and why were they there? Now, obviously, she had this relationship with this guy. But why was he and his brother there? Were there drugs other than prescribed drugs at the location? So you may well want to call in DEA to do the following. If, in fact, there were other drugs found, where did they come from? Because they're going to have a network of who are the drug distributors in or around where she resides. The other is even the prescription drugs running down, you know, were they correct? In other words, was she being prescribed things that she shouldn't have been prescribed? That's another angle to this. And it may have no relevance, but that's something they'll look into. Because it's all of that that will give you maybe better insight as to what happened to her. Apparently, she had addiction issues for several years. But what is it that actually took her life this time? And the toxicology may give you the answer or some of the answer to that, but that takes a while to come back.
Is this getting a little extra scrutiny because we're talking about a high-profile celebrity? In some way, this reminds me of what happened when Matthew Perry died.
Well, that's right. For whatever reason, high-profile people get high-profile attention from the media. I mean, when Lady Gaga's French Bulldogs were stolen, I mean, I was even talking about that. I mean, would we talk about your neighbor's French Bulldogs getting stolen? No. But that's just the way that the news ebbs and flows.
Panettiere was also open about her struggles with postpartum depression and addiction. She even revealed that her longtime partnership with skincare brand Neutrogena ended after she discussed postpartum depression during a live interview. She told podcast host Jay Shetty the ordeal made her realize how little people really understand about this condition, which the Mayo Clinic says is, quote, not a character flaw or a weakness, but a complication that can arise from giving birth. The Mayo Clinic also notes that postpartum psychosis is a more extreme and rare disorder than postpartum depression. But it's also a condition that can develop after a woman gives birth. The defense team for Lindsay Clancy, a Massachusetts woman on trial for the alleged killing of her three children, have argued that she suffered from postpartum psychosis. Here's more on that condition from Odyssey station WBBM News Radio in Chicago.
Only about 1 or 2 in 1,000 women experience postpartum psychosis. Dr. Kate Johnson, chair of psychiatry at Loyola Medical Center, says the severe depression and break from reality can develop after their bodies have gone through pregnancy and birth.
They will scavenge things from their own body. They will take calcium out of their own bones to make sure the baby has what they need. That definitely can cause problems for the mom in a physiologic kind of way. After delivery.
Dr. Johnson hopes Lindsay Clancy's trial shines a light on the problem while the country's behind in diagnosing and treating other mental illness more broadly.
Trying to then get a hold of somebody who knows and understands and has seen and treated and feels comfortable with postpartum depression or postpartum, just perinatal mental health in general can be really, really challenging.
Nancy Hardy, News Radio 105.9 WBBM.
Chad Benson at Odyssey station KRLD 1080 in Dallas did a deeper dive into the Clancy case and postpartum conditions this Friday.
The question is she guilty of murder? Not did she do it? And I know that sounds weird, but if you're not following the case, and it's got a lot of headlines about Lindsay Clancy. This was a woman who in 2023, January 2023, sends her husband out to run an errand, and then she proceeded to kill her three children. So you're thinking, well, obviously she did it. Yes, but we know about postpartum depression, but there's also something called postpartum psychosis. And it's very interesting to look at this case because I was, you know, I talked about this the other day when my wife had Charlie, my little one. She turns 8 in a few days. She had postpartum depression. Yeah, think about it, right? You've got this living being inside of you, feeding off of you. Your hormones are out of control. And then it's get on with life because here comes the baby and all the other things. And there was some absolute postpartum depression. Now, did it rise to the level of psychosis? Not even close. But a lot of women are speaking up and they're angry because they feel like she's getting a raw deal. Now, here's the thing. She killed the kids. Nobody is arguing that he did it or that it was some other monster. She killed the kids. And she said she heard voices that said that she needed to kill the kids. She heard voices after she went to the doctors and she got, you know, prescribed SSRIs and they only got louder. I mean, there's no doubt about who did it. The question is, can she sell the jury? And it sounds weird to say that it was a break. Now, many people have come forward and said that when they spoke to her, she was having a breakdown. She sought medical care. She went all of these things that, you know, that you would say, okay, this is not somebody who just magically did something and came up with some sort of diagnosis. But her treating psychiatrist said she never appeared to be psychotic. Prosecution said, look, she created the opportunity by sending him away so she could do it. but her chaplain, her mother, several other people that were associated with her, family and friends, all said that she had changed and that she had threatened to harm the children. And after it happened, she even told the chaplain that she said the kids were safe now. So it is, you know, it's, again, how real is this postpartum, you know, psychosis? It's real. Some people have it and they don't do anything. There's a lot of questions too about, obviously, there was plenty of signs. Why did nobody pick up on those signs in a much different way? Talking about family members, maybe saying, look, we need to take the kids away from her. And, you know, and more and more people are speaking out about this. And it is a fascinating and tragic story. And I've watched a lot of the stuff and I've been reading a lot of it. And my wife and I have talked about it because obviously, you know, she's following it. And it's because it's children. Because you're a mom. You know, you go back and you've seen some of these people that have done stuff to their kids. And was it an incident that they had? It was a momentary break that they really were psychotic. Or was it an excuse? I mean, it's such a hard thing. And to label everybody as evil and a killer and they did this. I mean, you're killing your three kids. There's got to be a little something wrong with you. I mean, to do that. And you know, we can go back and talk about all these women in the past that have done, you know, these things. And there's been plenty of them. I mean, is there? Is there a break? And it is a hard thing because it is a tragic thing. It is an awful thing. It is the thing where you sit there and you go, it churns your stomach because you think of those three little kids and what she did. But then you have a lot of people that come out and say, no, she's just evil and she needs to rot in hell. And my buddy comes who works at the local station comes on before me. He thinks she's just evil. She needs to rot in hell. She needs to be executed. And then there's no such thing as this. And I don't think it's as easy as there is or isn't. I think there's a lot more to it. And, you know, she's got her supporters and there's plenty of them out there. It's a fascinating thing when you think about the psychosis. Could somebody have a break that the mind, you know, and we've talked, you know, like you get a lot of people there, they're, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity. That rarely happens anymore. I mean, it just doesn't. Very rarely does it happen. But we were talking yesterday, and I've said this over the years, is how can you look at somebody like a Jeffrey Dahmer and think to themselves that that's a normal thing? That was, you know, eating a human being and keeping their body parts in the fridge. I don't know. The mind, all of it, it's, and this has, of course, become an incident where, you know, you sit there and you've got this, a lot of people who are there to support her because they've been through postpartum depression. And, you know, they look and say, you know, there by the grace of God go I. But it doesn't mean that she's, you know, not guilty. She did kill her children. It's just, did she do it? And she had no way to stop herself because she had had a break with reality. It's just fascinating and tragic.
The Mark Cox Morning Show out of Odyssey Station 97.1 The Talk in St. Louis also discussed the Clancy case, specifically the role medications play in it.
Kim, she's the mother accused of murdering her three children and apparently trying to take her own life while battling postpartum depression. That's the argument the defense is using here. It's raised a lot of eyebrows. And they asked Dr. Drew about this yesterday on Hannity's show. And his question was, they found out this woman's medication list. Many of the medicines she was on don't interact well with the others.
His question was, in today's medical environment, with everything that's online and these health charts and everything, like if you're with BJC or, you know, SSM or whatever it happens to be, your doctor can pull up your entire list of medicines and look at them.
That was the exact question I had asked when I initially talked about this, was how was that not known? Because, first of all, you're asked usually what other medications are you taking? And I understand you can easily lie about that on some medical form. But don't you think that she would have wanted to list those because she'd want to make sure that they weren't having some weird reaction with any new medication she was prescribed?
Or did she doctor shop?
Dr. Drew said the U.S. has, quote, eviscerated primary care, making medications and prescriptions a bit of a complicated topic.
I don't have a primary care physician. There is one person I went to try to set that up. But if I'm sick, because I'm not sick very often, I go to urgent care. It's just easier.
That's part of the problem. But it's also not the answer, because my mother will go to the same doctor she's been seeing for 5 or 6 years, and we'll go in and sit down in an appointment, and they will look at her and say, are you on any, what medications are you on? And every time my answer to them is, whatever you prescribed her. Mm-hmm. Look in your chart. Why are you asking me?
Yeah.
And I guess ultimately what they're asking is, has another doctor prescribed something we don't know about? That would be a better way of asking that question. That's not the way they ask it.
Well, they're probably not taking the time to look it up because they truly don't know. They ask the same questions over and over again. And again, I get you have to update information and things like that. But when my son had to get stitches the other day, I went to a Mercy Urgent Care. I said, hey, they said, oh, we can't help you. Go to this one. It was within the same network, Mercy. And I said, can you please call them first and make sure that they can handle this? And they said, we don't have their number. We have no way of talking to them. You're in the same network and you can't, there's no number. There's not a single person that you can get a hold of over there. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I agree. All right.
John Grayson, Scott Parks, and Sam Stevie III of the Dana and Parks Show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City weighed in on the Clancy case, too.
Are you interested at all in the trial that's going on right now in Massachusetts?
I find it fascinating. Yes, I find it fascinating.
My wife is obsessed with this trial and has been going through and looking at every bit of commentary that's out there on the web and people. I mean, if there is a more hated person in the country right now, not than her, than her husband, I don't know who it is. People hate this man like poison. No. It's getting really, really ugly. But I don't know if you heard at the top of the hour, something interesting happened today because they broke for lunch and then never came back. The judge just said, unforeseen circumstances, we're sending everybody home. We'll see you tomorrow.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
See, I do not think that she, and I almost feel like I have to preface this by saying that, of course, what she did, and nobody's denying that she killed her three kids.
Not so fast. There is a conspiracy theory out there that he killed them.
Okay. Sam, what have you done to John?
I didn't say I believed it. I just said it's out there.
Don't blame me. You're the one that's been working with me every day.
I do not think she should go to prison for the rest of her life. I do think she should probably go to a mental detention facility for a very long time. You know, and am I following it gavel to gavel? No. Am I keeping up on it? Hell yes, I am. And because I do think that this is a very interesting story. But there is no doubt that she was sending people signals, I am not well. Oops, sorry.
Yes.
I just hit the microphone. Beg your pardon.
She was begging for help.
Yes.
And she was largely ignored.
I'm thinking about doing harm to the kids. And, you know, mental health in this country, including postpartum depression, which I'm starting to really believe she had they use an extra word on it.
Psychosis.
Thank you. I'm starting to be convinced that she had the psychosis of postpartum depression. And she was begging for help. But, you know, with so many other different kinds of mental health issues, problems in this country, we are slow to get on this bandwagon and accept that, you know, that your brain is just like any other part of your body, except better and more important. And when something is not working up here, or you know the wires are getting crossed, well, you know, suck it up, buttercup. You know, depression is one of the most misunderstood things in this country.
Absolutely.
You know, I remember when Robin Williams died a handful of years ago, and we ended up talking. He died literally at the tail end of one of our shows. And of course, we started talking about it right out of the gate at 2 o'clock the next day because it was Robin Williams and he had killed himself, right? And I lost track of how many people would write in on the text line or call in on the phone lines and say, what did he have to be depressed about? He had everything. He was famous. He was rich. It doesn't work like that.
Right. No. No, it's not what do you have to be depressed about. You either are or you aren't. And if you are, there's very little outside of therapy and medication and things like that that you can do about it. Yeah. So, yeah, the idea that he had all this money and all this fame, he should be happy. No, that's not how that works.
Just very quickly, and then we got to get to a really short break. But think about all the famous people that have killed themselves. That people would say, well, what do you have to be depressed? I think about Brad Delp, the lead singer of Boston.
Boston, yep.
Who killed himself by lighting a charcoal grill in his bathroom and closing the door. That's how he killed himself. Yeah. People would say, what did Brad Delp have to be depressed about? He had everything. He was lead singer of Boston. He was rich. Because it doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. It's that simple.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to KDKA Radio in Pittsburgh, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WWJ News Radio in Detroit, WCCO News and Talk in the Twin Cities, Tommy Tucker out of WWL in New Orleans, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, KNX News in Los Angeles, WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, The Chad Benson Show out of KRLD 1080 in Dallas, and The Mark Cox Morning Show out of KFTK in St. Louis. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.